Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. There's nothing quite like finding something we stored away long ago in some dark corner that we completely forgot, only to open it once again to a flood of memories and delights. If you've had that kind of experience or can imagine it, you will enjoy our guest today. Jerry Brown is an author and historian who has recently completed a book called Memories from a Gray Wood Box, Stories from the Great War. It recounts the time during the First World War in Cobourg from a very different perspective. And in light of the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I this past year and the very successful Armistice 18 celebrations in Cobourg, I am so pleased to welcome Jerry Brown. Welcome, Jerry.
That's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
There's a really interesting story behind the genesis of this book that you recount in your introduction. Could you share it?
Well, basically, it's a long-term thing that I've had. Realistically, as a retired history teacher, I was disappointed sometimes in the sorts of things that we were being required by curriculum designers to do. We talked about the big things. We talked about Napoleon. We talked about treaties. We talked about political theories. But what we didn't talk about was day-by-day stuff, the way people actually lived in a variety of times and places. And it's always seemed to me that those are the things that really matter. Constitutions do have an influence, obviously, on us, and politicians in Ottawa influence our lives as well. But it comes down to, for example, what's available in the grocery store. Can I afford it? Am I warm? Am I dry? Are my kids safe when they go to school? And when we talk about the big things, sometimes we lose track of the small things. But the small things are where people really live. And I've always wanted to talk about that stuff.
So that's your philosophy towards your writing. But this particular book, what was the gray box and where did you find it?
Well, the gray box actually is a gray wooden box that's in my garage. And it was something that we purchased at an auction sale quite legitimately, as I described in the book. It did not contain a whole bunch of memories because those are the memories that I made up. But the story that I wanted to tell was, what would it be like to be a young person growing up in Cobourg before and during and just after World War I?
So what did you base this on then? Did you have some documentation that you started with and then built on that?
A lot of the work that we've find in Cobourg for the early 20th century really comes from the work of a couple of historians, most notably Henry Climo. The difficult part of researching something like this is that day-by-day stuff doesn't get caught in newspapers. It doesn't turn up in the archives very often. And so what I had to do was in a sense, read between the lines. And I think that's what historical fiction often does for us. It allows us to do day-by-day detail. It allows us to be one of the people who was living at a time and in a place. It doesn't matter whether it's – I mean, I look at the people that I – see, I've been reading historical fiction since I was 8 years old. My mother presented me with Horatio Hornblower and that kind of stuff. And more recently, there have been a lot of people writing some very good, frankly, some very well-written pieces. I think particularly of Patrick O'Brien, who's best known for a very long collection of Napoleonic period naval battles. Maurice Walsh is a guy that I enjoyed immensely. Most people have never – virtually no one's ever heard of Maurice Walsh. He's actually an Irishman who writes about a variety of things that range from fly fishing in the Scottish Highlands to the realities of the Irish Republican Army and their brutal battle against the British Army in the days after the Troubles in Ireland in 1917.
So, but history, writing historical fiction is an art form that blends both accurate, real historic facts,
yes,
with a narrative.
Yes, it does. And it's funny because just at the end of the book, I was really blunt about it. A lot of the earlier works, especially, probably because of the implications of legalities, always started off with, this is a work of historical fiction. None of the persons is real, nor should be viewed that way. And then they start talking about Napoleon or whatever. And obviously, Napoleon's a real figure. And when they put him in a book, he does things that perhaps someone might not be happy with. I made this up, but I also said I want this to be as realistic as possible. Now, of people that are actually in Coburg at the time and named specifically, I think the only one that's actually here and named other than just in passing the officers, Odell, for example, with the commanding officer, with one of the military battalions. I mentioned the mayor as a politician, mm-hmm. but everyone else is simply a made-up character who represents a person or a group of people living in Coburg. Arthur Gerson, the key character, is Irish of background. Mm-hmm. Talks a little bit occasionally about the differences between being an Irish Catholic and an Irish Protestant, mm-hmm. or the Irish against the Scots or the rest of the world. But that's not what's important here. I think what I saw – see, we're relatively new in Coburg. We've been here mm-hmm. 4 years. And what I saw in this community was an incredibly tight-knit place where people cared about other people. And so my real theme behind all this is, how did the people of Coburg support one another in this terrible challenge that World War I presented, both to the soldiers themselves and the nurses who served with them and the doctors who went from here to look after them over there. But the people here still in the town, raising money, putting on banquets for groups of men who were heading off to the train station. It's really quite an incredible community then. Quite frankly, I think it is still today.
So when you go to create your protagonist, Arthur Gerson, you must have needed to understand the context around him, the life that was going on him. Did you go to the archives? Did you look at personal documents? Where did you get the materials that allowed you to create this fictional character and yet make him real enough that we believe that he is somebody who is alive and doing the things that he was doing in the book as you describe?
Well, we certainly spent a lot of time in the archives, and they used us extremely well when we were doing the research and provided us with many of the illustrations, the photographs that are complementing the text in the book. Staff there was incredibly useful. The other person, two other people particularly, helped a great deal. As I mentioned, at the end of the book, one collection of pictures in particular came from an archive which is quietly stashed away in the room behind the bar down at the Legion. But beyond that, it's a reality of small towns to begin with. Now, I grew up in Toronto, so how do I know that? Because my dad grew up in a little place on Georgia Bay called Meaford. Mm-hmm. And Meaford is the quintessential small town. It was 2,000 people when I was first there as a young child, and it's now up in the fives range. But stories that people told, there's the story early on in the book about a very nasty old woman who gets carted around in her outhouse on Halloween night. That story is actually true. And I'm not going to tell you who the people were, but I do actually know two of the four young men who made a public statement about what a nasty person she was and how she deserved to feel some of the anguish that she caused other folks.
So when you're trying to get inside a character's head, I thought it was really interesting because you gave certain attributes. You mentioned some of them already, that Arthur was Irish, and you talk a bit about the context. But there's a story that you tell about an accident with his hand. And I'm wondering if you could tell that story and then tell us why you included that. What was important about that?
Well, let me back up a little bit and say where some of the ideas come from. My odd way of finding storylines actually occurs completely unconsciously in the shower. And I talked to another writer, well-known around here, and maybe I shouldn't mention his name, so I won't. But we were talking about this, and he said, mine come, again, spontaneously when I'm shaving. Mm-hmm. And the shower makes a certain amount of sense because one of my kids told me when I said that to him, yeah, but your brain's working better because it's got hot water on it. But when I'm shaving, I'm focused pretty carefully on what I'm doing to my face. So I don't know how that works. I guess part of it is you get uncluttered. Anyway, what happens in terms of storylines? Sometimes you want to get yourself someplace. Now I'm starting on something new, which is going to be Coburg with a newly arrived Anglo-Irish family in the 1820s, just about the time that Peter Robinson was bringing all the Catholic group and taking them up to what became Peterborough. And I need to get her in a certain time and place. And I've spent 2 weeks trying to figure out how I'm going to make that reasonably rational and sensible. You want to talk about Mr. Gerson and his accident as well. I needed somebody in town who was young, like the men who were going overseas, but who could not go, because it was going to be unbelievable if he just decided he didn't want to go because it was scary. No, that's nobody's going to pay any attention to a character like that. So he needed to have some injury. I considered my grandfather's scenario. He came from Cornwall in 1913, as in Cornwall, not Cornwall, Ontario. Mm-hmm. Went to Borden because he volunteered and got scarlet fever. So they sent him home and said, you can't go overseas. We're too much of a risk. Well, I thought about that, but, you know, that's been done. So what he did is he and a bunch of his friends were riding their bicycles, which in those days they referred to as wheels. And they were across in front of Victoria Hall. And a horse and wagon, because that's what was on the main street, pulled away from the water trough, and he had to swerve out of the way of the vehicle as it was coming out, and was hit by another horse passing in the outside lane, sort of thing, 401 all over again. Fell off his bicycle, spraddled on the ground, reached out trying to save his chest and face, and the back wheel of the wagon ran over the third and fourth fingers on his hand, crushed it very badly. And they scampered him up. Oh, that's another character who's real. The doctor is actually a real character in town. And so they popped him up to Division Street and promptly put him under, which was relatively new at that point, so that they could work on the hand. Managed to save the rest of his hand, but he lost two fingers and therefore obviously was not a candidate for overseas. You're not going to be going bayoneting people very well with a hand and a half. So he stays here, but his friends go. And where that going gets to be really interesting to me is that nobody went without an incredible amount of public support. So the men were in the armories, and our armories were a focal point for a number of other folks coming into town. In fact, there were people here from as far away as Ohio volunteering for the Canadian Forces and temporarily stationed in and around our armories, now the police station, and in a variety of houses in town. And they marched as a group to what is now the CN station or VIA station, always accompanied by at least one band, mostly two bands. Occasionally, we've even borrowed a band from Port Hope, all that rivalry notwithstanding. And people lined the streets and people rode along and walked along beside them. And they walked along, whether it was 2 o'clock in the sunny afternoon, or in one case, they marched up to the train station to meet a train that was supposed to be there at 11 o'clock at night. It was very cold. It was very windy. It was sluicing rain. They didn't even get onto the train until 2 o'clock. Nobody went home till all the boys went onto the train, latched it onto a train that was on its way to Montreal, and took them off to war. And then we walked home.
That's fascinating because you mentioned in the book, part of the narrative is you talk about the Archduke's assassination, which was the key event which ignited
the spark.
The First World War. And in that, you describe it wasn't a lot of impact here locally, a few headlines, but you didn't seem to put any significance. And yet, you're talking about once the momentum gets there, and you know, I think it was 31,000 Canadians by the October had enlisted.
That was incredible.
Incredible amount. And then you're talking just now about these incredible parades up and all this public support. From your research and your experience, what took place in between in Cobourg, where we went from this sort of this far-off event in Austria-Hungary to, oh my gosh, this is really important, this is our people, we've got to enroll, we've got to enlist, and off they go?
Well, I've often wondered about that. I mean, say my grandfather's a perfect example of the recent immigrant. His country was England, and he went to defend England, not to defend Canada. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of that was true even here. Mm-hmm. That, you know, this is was then an English, Irish, Scots community, and England, well, Great Britain by that time, and bits of Ireland, were at war. England was in danger. The English way of life was in danger. And we as a community bought into the idea, Canada as a community bought into the idea that they needed to support this war effort. Now, what we get out of that, and it's often focused on Vimy, but I think that's an easy specific focus, but it's the war itself that we created a Canadian identity because we were finally allowed to fight as a group of Canadians because we did the things that were necessary because we were supported at home as Canadians.
But do you think, though, that that was an outgrowth of the war? Or, you know, we're talking about early days. Was it more the British patriotism that was rallying these people and getting them energized to have these incredible public displays of support to march these kids up in the sluicing rain, all that stuff? Is you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, I believe, personally, it started as we are defending England and Great Britain. Mm-hmm. I think after a while, we realized that we were pretty good at this. And one of the things that comes out very clearly in a number of books, and certainly in the, and we'll talk about Mr. Ivy in a little while, but one of the local men who wrote a great deal about what it was like over there also talked about the way that Canadian troops were received when they arrived at Southampton on the south coast, moved into Sussex area south of London to do some more training to get ready for off to France and Belgium, and there were people there who looked at them and said, we were expecting people with dark skin and leather coats. They thought we had a group of indigenous people all dressed up as Indians. I don't know whether they thought they were actually going to be feathered or not, but pretty close to that. England had enough foggiest clue what it was like over in Canada. And so I think that cements our sense, too, of we are, you know, we're real people. We're a complex society. We're a good society. We are a valuable society. And we are social, and now we are military.
Fascinating. Before we go to break, would you be kind enough? Do you have a reading that you might be able to share before we go to break?
We can try something. The one thing that strikes me always, and I do this something from the early days for us first here, I think you raised an interesting point, though, Rob. We really weren't Canadian, and we had not understood that kind of identity until things like this happened to us. I wanted to talk very briefly about the Empress of Ireland, the Titanic scenarios. Okay. My great-grandparents were supposed to be on the Empress of Ireland. They were Salvation Army people. And so Arthur is sitting here saying, you know, the Empress of Ireland struck us as a very peculiar thing. It touched the lives of so many people, particularly, obviously, Cobourg Salvation Army folks. The idea that a stupid accident in fog could kill over 1,000 people in the middle of a calm night seems hard to grasp, especially as there's been so much hoo-ha about safety and lifeboats and all that after Titanic. It just didn't make any sense. On the other hand, a realistic view of the outside world was hard for us to get a grip on, too, as we were pretty isolated in our little town. you have to realize that we virtually never went beyond the town limits. That is to say, from the Kingston Crossing, where the Grand Trunk Railway crosses the highway at the toll gate east, out to the east, to the old mill site on Factory Creek on the lakeshore, and north as far as the core of the old courthouse at Burnham and Elgin. The harbor and the piers are at the bottom end. That's a small world, but it was our world.
That was beautiful. That was Jerry Brown reading from his new book, Memories from the Gray Wooden Box, Stories from the Great War. And on that note, we're going to take a break for some commercials. I am here with local historian Jerry Brown. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn. My guest today is local historian and author Jerry Brown, who has written the book Memories from a Gray Wooden Box, Stories from the Great War. Jerry, when you were doing your research, you mentioned about being in the archives, and I noticed throughout the book you often cite and present material from the Henry Ivy Collection. Who was Henry Ivy?
Henry Ivy was a young man growing up here. His dad was a doctor who moved to Cobourg from Western Ontario, just the other side, well, a little bit the other side of Hamilton, Jervis, Ontario. And the story begins in an interesting way because our first real contact with him is when the commanding officer in Halifax from Cobourg says, "Henry, how old are you?" And Henry said, 17, sir. You had to be 18 to volunteer. So because he was a friend of Dr. Ivy's, he sent us out, the commanding officer sends off a telegram, this is Odell, sends off a telegram saying, "Do I have your permission for Henry to go with us? We're ready to go on board." And the family said, "Yes, Henry can go." And Henry went. And Henry's got a really interesting collection of materials. And we got this from Sheila MacDonald, who is a great niece, I think is the correct connection there. Lent us a tremendous collection to research stuff. Medals, his letters. And I think Henry is the quintessential Canadian to me, the quintessential Canadian volunteer. Yeah, he's young, enthusiastic, but when he – and he dies. Unfortunately, his last letter home, which is newsy and friendly and relaxed, as all of them were that I read, you know, "We're doing this, we're doing that, you know, one of these days it's going to warm up enough." This was in the spring of 17. "And it'll warm up pretty soon, and I'll be able to get a bath in a shell hole." And we realize what kind of muddy water that's going to be and all that kind of stuff. But no, this was okay. The tragedy is that by the time that letter arrived, and letters were taking, as near as I can work out, from his posting to their writing back to him. And there's quite a series of things that we were able to borrow there and read. Probably about 6 weeks for one direction from the front to Cobourg. So the family would have had his formal telegram with deepest regrets, "Your son is dead," pretty close to 6 weeks before his last letter arrived home. That letter which said, "I'm going to, you know, waiting for it to warm up a little bit so I can have a bath. Oh, by the way, everything is pretty good here. We're, you know, we've been building some new gun platforms. We have to work at night because otherwise the Germans shoot at us, but not to worry." That the positive nature of so many of the, and he's not the only one. There were other letters that we found as well that, you know, it was ugly. It was disgusting. It was filth. It was rot. It stank because there were bodies all over rotting. And then the soldiers didn't talk about those things in their letters. They talked about, you know, "We moved from here to there. We, you know, the Germans were kind of busy last night and we had to keep our heads down, you know, da-da-da-da. But, you know, oh, by the way, John's dead, but everybody else is okay." That sort of positive note was so characteristic of the soldiers' letters to their parents.
What goes through your mind when you first come upon that type of information that was shared with you about Henry Ivey, his diary, his notebooks, his medals. I mean, when you touch those kinds of things, do you have a reaction inside?
Like as in up and down your spine, tickle, 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 tickle? Absolutely.
What means the most? What moves you the most when you encounter those kinds of things?
I think it's the kindness and the humanity of so many of the young men who were over there that they did not wish their parents to know how bad it was. I mean, the news reports were there, the figures are there, how many people were killed, how many people were wounded, da-da-da. But those are always so impersonal that they don't apply to my family. And I think, I mean, I have never, ever, I'm sure there must have been some, but I have never, ever seen a letter which said, geez, I wish I hadn't done this. This is just, I mean, like I'm scared witless, da-da-da-da-da. It's awful. The Germans are terrible people, blah, blah, blah. Nobody said that. They said, you know, the Germans shoot at us sometimes, but we shoot back, and, you know, we're careful, and you know, things are okay, and, yeah, see you soon.
What then, I guess this is interesting because it's a contrast of ways that history gets presented to us, and I want to go back to this conversation because it started in the last section, and I want to come back to it. But you look at somebody like Percy Climo, who is a fantastic local historian, collected just reams of material and put it into books. And he has one, Let Us Remember, which is a series of letters. From soldiers back to Coburg, and plus a lot of official types of correspondence. So when you contrast that with what you're talking about, I wonder sometimes what is the significance of that in your mind when we look at those types of presentations? Why is one effective? Why is the other effective? What do each try to do to help us better understand this time in our own history?
Well, we have spent a great deal of time talking about in the formal histories of the war, about the numbers who were killed, the numbers who were wounded, about the battle plans. There are maps with the arrows and dotted lines indicating where the front was at various times during the day or week. But that's not what being a soldier is. That's what being a commanding officer, a training officer, perhaps would work with those things. I think when we really get down to it, we saw a great deal of courage, and I think the other thing that this war gave us that I don't remember ever seeing in any reference to Napoleon, for example. I mean, Napoleon going to Moscow. Brainless idea that was, but, you know, I mean, 10% of his men came home with him, that he took with him. But we don't talk about the individual in that. We talk about numbers, 200,000 or, you know, 2 million men went, 20,000 came home, whatever. But we had here, for example, at what is now our seniors' residence and such over at the old Victoria University, we had a hospital set up, and I have a little thing in the book where, you know, our hero goes to deliver apples. He was sort of delivery boy for a bunch of people because that was one of the things he could do. He had a bicycle and da da da. And he was an organizer of that, and that's another thing that I found really interesting. Young people going out to the farms and doing whatever needed to be done, whether it was just mucking out and carrying water to the cows, or picking apples or whatever. There actually was a provincial scheme to do that, but my understanding is that Coburg was really a year ahead of the rest of the world on doing that. But he goes up to deliver a bushel of apples or a basket of apples to them, and there are two men sitting in chairs wrapped up in their towels and their blankets, and they're just staring at nothing. And he speaks to them, and they don't say anything, they don't do anything, they don't move. And I've likened it, and that's our first description of what we then called shell shock. Got a more technical sounding term today, but shell shock works pretty well for me, understanding that you know, I have seen such terrible things that my mind simply cannot cope with this. And they are simply staring at nothing. And I likened it to, they're looking at a scene in a horror movie, and it's just only it gets stuck there, and they can't get it out of their heads, that what they saw was so ugly, it's irrevocably implanted in their mind, and they can't look at the tree that's beside them or the bushel of apples that we're carrying into to their hospital.
What's the role for you of poetic license? Because, you know, this is one of the tensions that exists in trying to write historical material.
Yeah.
Is that you've got all these facts that surround it, and yet you're going to tell us a story, and you get to go down the buffet of material, pull it together, and then somehow pull it all together so that it's going to be a believable, real story. What was the role of poetic license for you in this book?
Well, first of all, characters need to represent broader numbers of people. And if they don't do that realistically, if you've got one guy who does things that only one person ever did, then, you know, I mean, there's no point in writing a book about somebody who shoots 100 Germans as a sniper, because only one, well, actually two Canadians did that. One was a Métis from Manitoba. The other one was local. But you allow yourself, I think, as obviously you have to have. I mean, it's all imaginative, and sometimes poetic license gets caught in, I want to describe something. How the devil am I going to get myself around to being able to do that? So, and this is also the first book that I've written in first person, which makes it easier in a number of ways, because you can think as well as say and move.
But how do you, as a 21st century man, get inside the head of a wartime young man?
When the first book that I wrote was Prescott in the War of 1812, and in a sense it was easy there, because I actually did a great deal of the writing sitting on a picnic table about 6 feet from the St. Lawrence River, which was the center, the focal point of all of the, or a great deal of the action that went on there. We got up as far as Kingston and Sackett's Harbor, but a lot of it was just back and forth between Prescott in Ontario or Upper Canada, and Ogdensburg, New York. And you know, the constant there for me was the river, which goes by at about 4 knots. And has a little swirly thing just in front of where that bench is, because there's some shallow water there, and the freighters go by and that kind of thing. So that's easy. One of my favorite scenes in the whole thing is our hero is sitting on one of the benches along the edge of the beach, and one of his acquaintances from school, who has been injured and sent home, comes along and they sit down and talk, and that's one of the easy ways of doing this, from the specific to the general, or from the general to the specific, whichever way you want to go, because he talks about what happened to him. You know, he was injured, he was wounded, he was shot, he was da da da, and he went from here to there as they were trying to fix him. He got back on the hospital ship and so on, but he also is able to talk about the battle from a very specific and personal point of view. Mm-hmm. How do you make sure that, first of all, there's nobody alive who can tell me I was wrong because I was there and I know it wasn't that way. Mm-hmm. But that's not the point. How do you do that, I think, is a really interesting question, because it takes a lot of thought to get somebody describing what you think. And you raise a good point. I mean, I only have my own impression. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing, Rob, that's really interesting is that my impression changed a great deal during the process of writing about this event.
You know, In what ways?
Well, as a history teacher or as a student at the University of Toronto sitting in a lecture room, this was the world's stupidest war, fought by the world's stupidest generals, by a bunch of lackluster people who suddenly decided they wanted to be Canadian at Ypres. End of discussion. It wasn't a stupid – well, it was an unnecessary war, I'll give you that. But I don't think it was ever, from the Canadian point of view, particularly ill-fought or ill-thought through. There were terrible, terrible losses. But each one of those battles – led to better processing for the next one. And I think we, you know, we go through this thing, the description of the preparation for Ypres, which again we do as a one-on-one description in the book. You know, we plan. We have not – when the rolling barrage we've talked about, every time the soldiers move 100 yards farther, the heavy guns lift their trajectories and the shells fall a little farther away and they don't get killing our own men. But they fought this one on the ground in a model first. They prepared for basically all winter for a battle that takes place on Valentine's Day. The preparation was there. There were some extremely clever people. There was a Canadian artilleryman whose name escapes me. And that's the other thing. I got a book from just out of the blue from a writer in Montreal who had heard about what I was doing and said, here, maybe this is some use to you, which reminds me, I've got to send him a book back because that's what I said I would do. But you know, we were starting to consider not just the angle of the barrel and the aim point, but we were looking at humidity. We were looking at wind direction. We were looking at, you know, all kinds of temperatures, because all of those things have minute but calculatable bearing on where that shell that fires out of this gun that I'm just pulling the lanyard for and where it's actually going to land.
So those technical kinds of things sort of remove for us. And one of the things that you try definitely in reading the book, I found you're trying always to bring us back to a very human level. And you mentioned that in some of your earlier remarks. How do you feel when you're writing? Do you take on that person?
Oh, yes.
Do you become
that? Oh, yes.
So things like language and the way people would think and the priorities that they would have, where does that come from within you?
Maybe I'm all wrong. I don't know. I mean, I can't talk to anybody. My grandfather's the last man mm-hmm. standing sort of thing, you know. Uh-huh. I think it's probably the most complex reasoning process. It happens sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Sure.
You know, I've got to get this idea out. How am I going to do that? How does that fit in with the reality of where the characters are, what they're doing, who they are? I mean, there were funny things too. Like they're giving very large, very elaborate dinners for the guys who are heading off overseas. Mm. They're putting on plays. They're putting on all kinds of entertainment. But it all fits together. And what it gets them is the sense that this is a team. Which I think I think that's the reality of this war created Canada. Not one battle, but that all of the country did things for and collectively towards the effort that this war produced.
Do you think because you've only come to Cobourg recently and you've had the experience of becoming part of the community, do you reflect on whether that was that those personal relationships between the people as they came together, as they had their dinners, as they paraded and shared the experience as much as possible to send these young men off to receive the letters back about the deaths and to mourn. Does your experience now becoming part of Cobourg blend or reflect in any way, shape or form on your understanding of how the community worked back then?
Interesting question. I grew up in Toronto, went to University of Toronto, taught for 4 years in Toronto, so that's pretty remote. I went to a great high school and you know, I had some good friends and all that good stuff. But I moved in 1970 down to Prescott, which is 4,200 people, and taught for the rest of my career in the high school there. But that was, interestingly, that although it's a smaller community, it's a more disparate community because 65-68% of the population in the school came in by bus from a variety of farms and smaller communities, little corners and that kind of stuff. I felt like I belonged in Prescott okay. I lived in a little place called Roebuck, which was a corner store, a church, four houses, and a partridge and a pear tree. I moved from there to a slightly smaller place between there and Ottawa. Moved east of Ottawa, didn't like the community. Moved back into Prescott and felt, no, this makes more sense. I think what we have here sometimes gets pointed out as we're different from Port Hope, ha ha ha, and that it's a bit of a joke, but it's a very strong feeling in the community as well, and it's not necessarily a very positive one, but it's there. This community does stuff together. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, we were down at a local bar a couple of nights ago singing Christmas carols with a local musician and his best friend from Toronto. That's what Cobourg's about. There were people there who were, I mean, I'm 75. There were people there who were 20. We were all singing Christmas carols. I truly believe that this is a really magic place that has retained a great deal of the benefit of being a small place in spite of being just pushing the limit of becoming a city, if we're not careful. But trying to get inside the feel of the community wasn't really difficult. You know, we had a sort of block party the first weekend we were here in Cobourg. We felt like we were being treated well. We thought people wanted to see us, wanted to meet us, wanted to know who we were, wanted to know what was going on. And people have allowed us to be part of this community.
Do you have one last quick reading you could give us, a short one, just before we finish off?
I could read Henry Ivey's last letter.
That would be lovely.
Dear people, this is dated, as I mentioned before, probably four days before he died. Letters, papers, and parcels have all arrived okay. The battery being the guns, that we relieved in this position gave us the impression that we were coming to a terrible place. But as far as I can see, we have struck as good a spot as we might have had. There's quite a lot of work to do. We have to build concrete dugouts and platforms for the guns. We really have to do that all at night because the Germans are liable to be a little annoying during the daytime. Angus and Cecil has, I'm reading a very small print of a letter here, so excuse me, had heard about their father's death earlier in the day, and we're all being very sympathetic towards them. Last paragraph, there were big doings on our front last night, but I don't know just what exactly they were all about. We shall read about them in the English papers, the newspapers, which we get a day or so after they're published over there. As this is just my regular letter to let you know that I'm still alive and kicking, I must close. Love to all, Henry.
Beautiful. I'm so grateful that you've come out, and on behalf of myself and our listeners, thank you for coming out today and taking the time to share with us.
Well, Rob, it's been a pleasure. I really have enjoyed this process a tremendous amount, and I'm glad to be able to make something useful out of it.
And if you want to get a copy of Memories from a Gray Wooden Box, you can go to the website of the publisher, Lighthouse Press, and order a copy. Next week, I'm going to be talking to Colin Brown, a local lawyer and activist, about populism and its impact on local politics. Are we becoming angry and bitter about our politicians, or are we seeing a shift in the forces driving a vital change? So please tune in. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This, or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. If you'd like to listen to this or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this, Northumberland.